Unidos. That's California for welcome to the January 12th edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swaim, president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. You can find my friend and co-host David Bonson right here. He's an author, a political commentator, and the founder of the eponymous investment firm, The Bonson Group. Hello, David.
Hello, Will. Nice to have you here in the office once again.
You've been awake now for longer than most people are awake in a day, I think.
That may be true. I am, but I still think this is our best time to record. It's kind of mid-morning deal, and so now I have been up for, normally I would have been up for 6 hours by now. Today I've already been up for about seven. So you've kind of gotten a lot of the stuff you need to get done for the day, but it's still early enough that like we're ready to fire away. There are times when we record in the afternoon, and I think it's a little letdown. Not because I'm tired, but because in the morning, I can still lie to myself and say California can be saved. But by afternoon, I'm like, nah.
Nah, I get it. It's hopeless. Yeah. Well, on the theme of can California be saved, I had a piece yesterday in National Review. I'll post it in the show notes. It's on your run list, David, as actually the second item there. But I wrote a piece kind of just all I really did, dear listeners and dear David, was sweep together stuff that we've talked about on this podcast over the last many months. It's kind of a bill of indictment against the state of California. And the argument here is, and again, frequent listeners already know this theme, it's that California, it would be one thing if Californians voted for people and for things that were damaging only to Californians, but I try to lay out the ways in which you and I have discussed the impact of California's misguided policy stuff and politics on other states. So that's up on National Review right now, and I'll put it in the show notes. People can read that. But I also wanted to talk to you this morning because last couple of weeks we've been talking about abortion tourism in California and the fact that the governor wants to make this place a, he calls it a sanctuary for abortion seekers and providers. Wonderful use of the word sanctuary. And in the course of doing that, I was tracking like California's history on abortion access, as our friends on the left call it, and found this really interesting little anomaly, and it was reported best by National Review in 2008. It's called Reagan's Darkest Hour. And it turns out, pardon me, that in 1967, Ronald Reagan signed something called the Therapeutic Abortion Act after just 6 months as governor. And the state at that point had had a total of about 518 legal abortions in 1967. And in the remaining 2 years, the remaining two terms, that number would soar to 100,000 annually in the remaining two terms of Reagan's administration. So again, 518 in 1967, Reagan signs the Therapeutic Abortion Act, and the number just goes skyrockets to 100,000. Now, on the left, this has been cited as Ronald Reagan's a bad guy. He's disingenuous, and he, you know, tries to sort of hack the abortion, anti-abortion crowd, the pro-life crowd, in order to get elected president. But the fact is, this story lays out really elegantly that Reagan comes into office, and not a huge surprise, it says here, surprising as it may seem today, in 1967, abortion was not the great public issue that it is today. Reagan enters office uninformed. He's not even thinking about this. This is like a marginal issue in American politics. But then he starts to study this bill that is moving through the state legislature, and he decides, like, look, looking at the politics, they have enough votes to override a veto if I just flatly veto this thing. So he turns it into a kind of you must have a doctor's permission sort of. It requires that's why it's called Therapeutic Abortion Act, because it protects women who might be mentally damaged by having a baby rather than having an abortion. The abortion is saving them from psychological harm. Well, guess what happens next? That opens up the floodgates as doctors start writing exemptions for abortion. So Reagan learns his lesson, and this is what's most significant about the article in the National Review. Again, I'll post it in the show notes. This is, by the way, Paul Kenger and Patricia Clark Derner. I don't know either of them.
Who wrote the article?
Who wrote the article, yeah, right, yeah. In 2008 in National Review. And they say that Reagan was so shocked by what happened next, not just Reagan, but even the Democratic author of the bill. He was so shocked by how doctors misused this exemption that he became an ironclad pro-lifer when he gets into office. in the White House. So just a really interesting little footnote to our conversation about California's role, because California did have an outsized role then in expanding abortion rights, and the left used the camel's nose under the tent flap there to just blow up that doctor's exemption thing into something that we now recognize as just almost unlimited abortion rights.
Well, they sure did, and the article was really good, not only for the history of what took place, for the kind of, you know, willingness to just call balls and strikes as to what happened, what Reagan's era judgment was, but also what Reagan learned from it, how he applied it. Now, you know, sometimes people make an error where, and Reagan was full of this because he was a Democrat, and his famous speech, 1964, marks this moment where you could just see and truly ideological conservatism that came from the Republican convention at the time at which Barry Goldwater was nominated. And Reagan, 64, 66, becomes governor. He's at that point, he's Reagan. And this bill was signed not when it was the old, you know, Democrat Reagan. This was where Reagan was more informed, and this was an error judgment. And there's other things we've talked about on the podcast. You know, our buddy Bob has brought up some of the issues with union.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there's some difference of opinion on some of the things that happened and what some of the ramifications were. But see, in this case, they're honestly presenting it as a mistake at a period of time where Reagan was one of us, so to speak. But in this case, the mistake was failing to see that it was an ideological one. It was a tactical one.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where legal precision becomes important. Piety is not a substitute for technique. And also, I think the ability of well-meaning governors, but sometimes even legislators at the federal level, to remember what activist courts can end up doing. You know, there has to be a sense, I think, in executive leadership, which would be more gubernatorial and, of course, presidential, to be thoughtful about the lay of the land in the judiciary, the lay of the land in the legislator. And in hindsight, everybody on the pro-life cause has 20/20 vision to see where this was a mistake. But it's not hard for me at all to understand what Reagan was thinking at the time mm-hmm. he signed it. Things move fast these days. And I thought it was a fascinating article. And then one of the things they point out was that Bill Clark had mm-hmm. advised then Governor Reagan on this, and Reagan was so just overtly pro-life and so unconcerned with where he may offend the so-called moderate Republicans or the independents, and let alone the leftist Democrats. There was a time where people knew they just weren't going to get those votes mm-hmm, anyways, so mm-hmm. just go do the right thing mm-hmm. and let it shake out. But they put out a book that I remember having on a coffee table in my house when I was a little kid. And it was a collection of all the like very pro-life things Reagan had done. So all of it were quotes from Reagan, but this Bill Clark gentleman put it together. And there was a movement from Republicans, including pro-life Republicans, to ask Reagan not to publish it,
mm-hmm.
to hold it till after the election.
Because this is 1984, right? He's facing re-election, and he's got this book in manuscript form.
And I think at the time it was 83, where Reagan's popularity by 84 was going to skyrocket, and maybe they wouldn't have been as concerned. But 83, we're still pretty close mm-hmm. to the 82 recession,
mm-hmm.
and so there was still some political ambiguity. By 84, we knew he was going to wipe Walter Mondale, you know, off the map, but Minnesota, that one,
that one got away.
God, we could have run the table. I think that Reagan saying, no, I'm not concerned with the politics of this. I don't need to hold this to second term. How many times does something get held to a second term for political reasons?
Right.
And perhaps appropriately so in some cases, but in this case, Reagan was willing to go put the thing out there. So, yeah, it's a disappointing moment in what a decision that Governor Reagan made, but no way I think takes away from the long term reality of Reagan as a true pro-life stalwart. And you know, you look to where we are now. I don't think, let me really stretch this and then I'll shut up. If it wasn't for what the Democrats did to Robert Bork, who Reagan nominated to the court, which was to me the single most egregious thing I've seen in a lifetime of how the Democrats have treated these judiciary experiences. So we look at the Clarence Thomas thing that ended up happening.
Mm-hmm.
We look, of course, at more recent history, the Kavanaugh mm-hmm. atrocity.
Mm-hmm.
It all started with Bork. By the way, it started at the hands of one of the greatest hypocrites in history of Ted Kennedy. That, in a way, caused the Republicans to wake up and say, these guys are at war. They're at war over Roe v. Wade. Now, I mean it metaphorically. But if it weren't for the Bork abuse, would they have had the courage to hold the line with Gorsuch, with Amy Coney Barrett, with what had to be done to get Kavanaugh across the finish line? So the fact we now have a pro-life majority on the Supreme Court, I don't think it happens without Bork. And Reagan was the one who appointed Bork. People bring up, by the way, Anthony Kennedy is who he put on the court to replace Bork when they Borked him. And Kennedy ended up proving not to be a pro-lifer. And that was one of several cases of judges kind of pulling one over on these guys, right? It happened, you know, I guess Souter with Bush Sr. is a little different. But my point being, that there was a legacy of work that for those now that are awaiting the Dobbs decision and one of the first pro-life victories that we'll have had in a generation, I expect, at some level, a lot of this was seeds planted by Reagan's presidency.
In 1967, 55 years ago. Okay, so let's cut to the Exodus, the California Book of Exoduses. The big news this week, David, was that Facebook's Meta, that's the parent company now, newly named by Mark Zuckerberg for Facebook's parent company, it's called Meta, and they are moving. They have just signed a massive lease in downtown Austin. Now, it's not clear from the reporting how much of this is a move and how much of this is a radical expansion of headquarter operations outside California in anticipation of a move. But here's the report from the Austin Business Journal. Months of speculation have come to an end as California-based Meta Platforms, parent company of Facebook, recently leased the entire commercial half of 6th and Guadalupe. It's a location of a 66-story high-rise under construction downtown that will be Austin's tallest building when finished. The social media company has also pledged hundreds more jobs in the Texas capital. So having destroyed or at least distorted California politics, Mark Zuckerberg's moving on to Texas, and he's got his new beachhead in Austin. To my friends at the Texas Public Policy Foundation, yeah, I'm talking to you, Buckley Morlot. This is like a new battlefield, I think, because this is not a company that hires people who vote in a way that will be consistent with Texas politics. It'll be very consistent with Austin. Which is very consistent with Silicon Valley or maybe even Portland or Seattle.
I think that's an overstatement. The data that we've seen by zip code voting has Austin to the left of Texas and to the right of Silicon Valley. And so I think it obviously is trending that way, but I don't think Austin is at Portland levels. I mean, that's way below the belt.
Speaking of below the belt, it might be because one night I'm walking around the Austin Capitol with friends from Texas Public Policy Foundation. It's late. They've closed down a bar. I've been drinking Coca-Cola, so I'm wide awake. And I get to watch a game of nude frisbee golf in the city. It's urban golf, frisbee golf and nude.
How long did you look at that?
Just long enough to realize that I had to close my eyes. And I can't forget the image.
Because if someone says, like, yeah, I had to watch an entire game of nude... at some point, it goes on to the looker, not the...
I couldn't stop watching. No, I looked away. Not out of a sense of guilt, but more of a sense of shared shame. Okay, so the big story, though, this week has really got to be two stories, I would say. There's the governor's announcement of the largest budget ever in California. That's $286 billion. It's a budget that calls for new healthcare initiatives that would expand healthcare to include everybody in California. Healthcare coverage, it's called like Medicare for All, basically, or Medi-Cal for All. And it would expand it, of course, to illegal immigrants of all ages. Previously, under Newsom, the expansion had been to undocumented people under 26 and over, I want to say 50 or something like that, 52. Now it's everybody. It doesn't matter what your age, doesn't matter where you come from. You can imagine the impact this will have on the state's resources, but the governor also boasts that we've got a massive $45 billion surplus. And I just want to footnote that number because he keeps talking about a surplus, and as frequent listeners to the show know, there is no surplus. This is an accounting gimmick. California Policy Center, I can put this up in the show notes too. We've done ample research on this thing, hampered only by one thing that I'll mention in a moment. But we've done ample research on this to show that the state really owes closing in on $2 trillion of unfunded pension liabilities, other post-employment benefits for government workers like health care, for instance, as well as bond debt out there. Because one of the ways in which the unions push for pay increases and benefit increases that encumber that pension system is by raising taxes. And when they can't raise taxes, they push local officials to produce bond debt. That is, to go to Wall Street and beg for cash that they have to pay back over time. The total cost of all of this is $2 trillion. That dwarfs a $45 billion paper surplus, as accountants would have it. There's a second caveat to that number that I want to point out. California, for the second time in 3 years under Newsom, has failed to report timely its financials. It is required to do so every year at the close of the calendar, pardon me, the fiscal year, rather. And we're now 9 months past that that period when we were supposed to have seen our last ones. We're now late on our most recent. So our ability at California Policy Center to analyze the true debt in California, the true unfunded liability numbers, is encumbered by the state's inability to actually do its own calculations. So I don't trust the governor's numbers for a variety of reasons. Those are two. I just think it's absurd when he says, well, you know, we're going to use a surplus to do, you know, cure homelessness, and we're going to climate change and health care for everybody, et cetera, et cetera. We've already talked at great length about, you know, expanding abortion access to anybody from anywhere on the planet. Literally, we're not exaggerating. Anybody can come from anywhere to California and get an abortion. If you can't afford one, one will be provided for you, kind of like public defense, which is actually legitimate anyway. So, David, you know, before I dig too deeply into this stuff, I just want to turn it over to you. You're the numbers guy. Thoughts about the California budget. And then we're going to come and talk about single payer health care, which is simultaneously a separate issue moving through the state house right now.
Yeah, I mean, you're right that the surplus thing is accounting gimmickry, and there's a lot of issues there. But I think I've been pretty consistent on the podcast over the years of pointing out that I am not as concerned with the accounting gimmickry that leads them to say things like there's a surplus as I am with the naked truth of their version of the story, which is that there is still a hyperdependence on highly cyclical revenue that is never addressed. There's no rainy day. There is no accounting for the fact that the primary issue on the balance sheet of the state is off balance sheet liabilities, which are unfunded. So I'm fine to go into the other areas that are clearly problematic. CPC does that reporting and research. I'm just simply pointing out that if someone just came and said CPC's wrong on all this stuff, it doesn't change the core issue,
which is the cyclical nature of the revenue,
the complete financial vulnerability of the revenue.
And can you talk about that? Because I you know what? I got to write this, or you've got to write it for us, and I'll get it published for you. Not that you need any help, but
the lesson of Gray Davis, you have the tech boom in the late 90s, and then not just Gray Davis, by the way, even different counties like the one here in Orange County, start giving away the farm and various expenditures. They recalibrate the budget around a elevated baseline of presumed revenue. And it's so highly capital gain dependent, and it's so highly sector dependent. Now, one thing that happened for California was after tech blew up, there was an awful lot of real estate activity that covered things up for a bit. And so but then that's where going into 08, we had California general obligation bonds that were trading at 80 cents on the dollar and really kind of lower. State GO bonds, a state that cannot declare bankruptcy, they have no business really ever trading below par value, other than because of maybe interest rate concerns. Our bonds tanked because everyone was well aware that our revenue base had collapsed to tens of billions below baseline commitments. Revenue was upside down from commitments by a massive amount. If I remember correctly, our annual spending then was 80, 90 billion, and now we're, you know,
closing on 300 billion.
But I think that even then, it didn't count unfunded liabilities. We always have had a pension issue. and those things have been exacerbated. You obviously then subsequently got a whole decade of very good stock market returns, but the state did very little to catch up on their unfunded liability. They're only the combination of poor funding with poor returns away from an utter disaster. Right now, they have poor funding with decent enough returns provided by robust capital markets. But, you know, these things end up changing. So people say, okay, well, for now, everything's fine. And that is totally true. And I've never been a Chicken Little on California's muni market. And some people in our camp have been, and I disagree with them. And I think they fail to see the ability of people to creatively kick the can and move things around and this and that. But, you know, Detroit did go bankrupt. Chicago so far has avoided it, but it's been a disaster. But my point is not what happens to muni bond investors. That's not my concern. I tend to think that it's true that blue states that get more favorable pricing because of the perceived higher risk in their muni market, that those are generally good investments because of the moral hazard. Ultimately, I don't think a government that doesn't let Citigroup and General Motors bondholders get murdered is going to let California bondholders get murdered. I think it's a fair investment thesis, but it's nothing to do with what we're talking about. We're talking about the governance of the state. Is California one day going to D.C. hat in hand? I suspect it will. But I'm not just saying it's next year. What I am saying is you can't say, as Jerry Brown did after 2013 and Prop 32 passed, hey, all these billionaires in Silicon Valley seem to love us, and then have a state, have a period where all these Silicon Valley companies are leaving, San Francisco's emptying out, Elon Musk is going, we have state legislators telling our key entrepreneurs to F off, and then you go, no, we're going to be fine. Well, you know, you said we're fine because of these people, but now you have Austin and Phoenix and Salt Lake City and Denver taking our great jobs, and what I think we're ultimately headed to is someone on the left has to admit what I've known forever, which is, yeah, California does actually kind of get away with it because of very, very wealthy people that are able to afford the taxes and not motivated enough to move away. And yet we're okay with that. We're okay with no middle class in the state. We're okay that regular suburban families can't afford it. We're okay that the quality of life is degraded around culture war decisions, around a failing public school system. We're okay to be the most lucrative state in the country and one of, people love pointing out, one of the most lucrative countries on earth, if it were its own country. We're okay with that and still coming in 42nd place in reading and 45th place. So we're going to like compete with Mississippi and Alabama for public school results, and we're going to say we're competing with France and Germany for economic results. So someone's screwing something up real badly. And the Bible says to those whom much is given, much is required. California was given a lot, so therefore much more should be required of this state.
Well, and the legislators think the same. They just think that that leadership shouldn't be in the areas necessarily of education or actual health outcomes or road building or wildfire management mitigation, but climate change. Because here's the great headline that I saw repeatedly. Here's the one from Sacramento Bee. Gavin Newsom seeks to reclaim California's status as climate change leader in his budget. Here's what's fascinating about this piece, and I think it's a really well-written piece by a guy named Dale Kassler at Sacramento Bee, is it really points out that part of Newsom's budget is signaling to folks on his left that he's still the environmental guy. The article has a quote here. It's, let me see if I can find this. Here we go. 2 months ago, while attending the Glasgow Climate Summit, let me stop there for a moment and remind everybody, Newsom bailed on the Glasgow Climate Summit at the last moment. Unclear why, although he claimed it was because he wanted to go trick-or-treating, I believe. Was that right? I think it was in October.
Was he trick-or-treating at a Getty wedding?
Then he shows up at the Getty's wedding.
Well, hey, there were a lot of treats.
Okay, so 2 months ago.
You remember trick-or-treating with caviar and champagne when you were a kid, right?
I do, and literal rock stars. 2 months ago, while attending the Glasgow Climate Summit, Assembly Speaker Anthony Rendon told CalMatters that, quote, I don't at all feel we are leading the world anymore, he says of California. The state auditor said California is likely to fall short of reaching its greenhouse gas reduction goals for 2030. So the governor, in announcing his budget, talks about electric cars and buses and trucks and 100,000 new electric charging stations. So the government's going to get into the business of basically building, you know, fuel gas stations, essentially, for electric cars. So electric recharging stations, 100,000 new ones. This is going to be awesome to watch that 100,000 number get explained away in the, you know, over this budget cycle. But that's the, what the governor's promising. And he says, you know, we've no one else is committed to doing more in this space, that is, of climate change, than Gavin Newsom himself. So my favorite line there is, there are lots of conversations to have about all this stuff. We have work to do, many parties, many conversations, lots of balls in the air. If Trump had said something like that, the left would be going ballistic about the lack of detail about how he's actually going to, you know, really literally fight climate change by doing these kinds of, I think, virtue signaling sorts of moves. The story is loaded with quotes from environmental leaders, environmentalists, who say that, you know, Newsom's not doing enough. Nice to see him do this thing. But it's fascinating to me that we have a group of people who have zero knowledge about how to make a business grow, but really understand fundraising through direct mail, which is to say the climate's in danger. Here's a polar bear swimming in the Arctic, which is shrinking. And you have to get out of your car, and that's why you should vote for Gavin Newsom. Remember, that's what the LA Times told us during the recall, was that we, in order to save the planet, we had to reelect Gavin Newsom and fight back the Republican recall.
Well, that's quite a big motivation, you know. Yeah. One suggestion I have is that both sides take away that sensationalism as election campaigning. Like, you must vote for this person, otherwise the results are Armageddon, mm-hmm. or the apocalypse.
Flight 93.
That whole thing I don't really care for on either side. And, of course, the problem is that people on our side will say, no, you don't understand. It's true this time.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, it can't be true this time when it wasn't true the last 8 times.
Right.
And if you want me to show you that I take seriously what is on the line, I'll walk you through how that works. But you are now saying something that plays into the left's hand. We argue the constitutional framework is a really healthy thing for the country. And when you go down this path of saying, if Newsom is reelected, we're all going to die, and it's going to, and the whole entire country's over. What you've said is that the Madisonian protections, the constitutional genius of separation of powers and all that, that they don't really work, that you don't believe in them. So I think that's a bad play. But back to this climate thing with Newsom, the left is right now, I think, putting themselves in a very precarious position for some of the same reasons that the right has done as well with Flight 93-like talk. And that is, they have issues that they want to go after. It seems to me, you tell me if you're reading it the same way I am, they're trying to act as if this election fraud voting rights stuff is this major issue. And on the facts, it's just so clearly not. And I think there are enough reasonable people seeing through it that are like, what are you talking about? But I do believe their doom and gloom stuff with climate has been so prophetically ineffective for over a decade that now with COVID stuff, with voting rights stuff, they got a lot of those things out there too. And it's not just climate. Well, first of all, there's subdivisions to climate. It's mm-hmm. global warming. Mm-hmm. It's methane emissions. They got all things mm-hmm. that are going to kill mm-hmm. us. There's obviously the COVID stuff. But I wonder if they face a decade ahead of Chicken Little problems. Because I think there's a lot of arguments to make to a center-left state like California as to why Newsom is better than Larry Elder, or why Newsom's better than whoever else the case may be. They could just argue on the basis of he's a Democrat and mm-hmm. you're a Democrat mm-hmm. and these guys aren't.
That's right.
But when you go down this path, I think some people, like, vote for Newsom or the planet's going to blow up. I think some people are like, is it?
Well, when you talk about the Constitution, and I want to be as fair as I can be to what I think are the reasonable folks who do worry about a kind of flight, for lack of a better phrase, let's call it the Flight 93 scenario. That is, of course, for those who don't follow along that carefully, Flight 93, famously, a bunch of people who are passengers on a jet on September 11th realize what's going on, and they blast into the cockpit, capture the hijackers, and steer the plane into the ground somewhere in Pennsylvania. Shanksville, I think it's called. And so their argument is that we're at a crossroads with the Constitution. And you can certainly see this. It was just, was it this morning that Joe Biden, I've been awake for a while too, Joe Biden came out and said that basically he's calling for an end to the filibuster.
He did it yesterday, but yeah.
Thank you. Okay.
But it was like, it was clouded in this is now or never.
Right.
Okay, well, they're not going to be able to do it, I don't think. So what happens when they don't filibuster for their stupid voting bills and then the democracy doesn't die? Because
right.
they're now saying you either vote for this or it's over. And I believe that affects voter turnout. Like, I personally believe when we said, if you vote for Obama, it's the end of America, and it wasn't the end of America, that, like, it hurt the turnout in the second, in the reelection case with Obama and so forth, right? There, and I could go on with a million examples. It's always false prophecy, because just because the way the world turns.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, do they have more lives left in them of false prophecy?
Yeah, of course they do. Absolutely.
I think that they're using some of those lives.
But yeah, and I think the public forgets. You and I are old enough to remember going back decades now that there have always been these false promises. Gosh, I was a little kid. I was probably 15 or 16 years old. Jimmy Carter's running for president, and a full-page ad appears in, I think, the LA Times. My family got both the Register and the Times. And it's a full-page ad that says Jimmy Carter is a tool of the Soviets and the Chinese Communist Party, and if elected, he will turn us over to those people. And of course, that didn't happen. And you know, this is just a little nudge in the psychic life of young Will Swaim. So I take your point, but I just think the public is infinitely gullible. You know, that we really are, the majority of us, just not able to pay attention. The majority of us are just trying to get through to Friday and aren't thinking really deeply about a lot of this stuff.
Well, I think it's true in general that scaring people is an effective voting thing. I guess what I'm saying is you can scare people with your taxes are going to go up. You can scare people with crime is coming to your neighborhood. You know, and those things can be true and untrue. And the left has their issues and the right has their issues. And you want, you know, I'm the stickler for making it all be true, which probably limits my political effectiveness. But I guess what I'm getting at is on climate, it does seem to me that that is an issue where people, like I'm seeing it right now with Omicron. I don't believe that the vast majority of leftists, and I don't mean the crazies, mm-hmm. but the vast majority of leftists, I don't think they're any different any more than me on this issue. I think they're like, yeah, if I get it, I get it. My kid get, you know, get a cold. We got to go on with our lives. I'm tired of my kid playing outdoor soccer with a mask on. Like, I think most people, and the reason being is that all these different things did not come to be.
Right.
And right now, I wonder if climate is going to become that issue for the Democrats. Because Newsom, the non sequiturs in that piece you shared, the idea that like the whole planet, which I've looked at Earth in satellite photos,
mm-hmm.
and I've looked at California on flat maps,
mm.
we are a really big state in terms of driving from Eureka to San Diego,
mm-hmm.
but we're not that big in the whole scope of Earth. And the idea that Newsom, that there's something that's going to ruin the world, the whole entire ozone layer is gone,
mm-hmm.
and California can reverse what China and India are doing.
But yes, and that's the problem. But they really do like the posturing of global leader, right? I mean, this is like we are influential, we are moral, we are the bright city on a shining city on a hill. It's that,
so what did Obama get done for China's carbon emissions?
Zero. They're worse.
And what is Newsom going to get done for India's
not
carbon
a thing.
Emissions?
Not a damn thing.
Now, I will say this, though, and you're not going to agree, and a lot of listeners aren't. I'm willing to give Newsom a shot.
Tell me.
At going to India. At reducing carbon emissions.
I think we're sending Gil Garcetti over there.
No, but if Gavin is a global leader, and
yeah.
This is the man, this
I
is the
like
time.
I like your thinking.
I'm willing to give it a shot.
Newsom to India, please.
Can you imagine the look on Newsom's face of disappointment in the party scene once he gets to India's fine
yeah.
dining? This is a man who is accustomed to French laundry and Getty weddings.
Right.
And I think Calcutta is not going to cut
do
it.
Anything. Yeah.
See what I did there?
I did. You know, we're talking a lot about numbers here, and I think it's just I want to pause and point out that the state auditor, Elaine Howell, who you and I have cited many, many times in this show, who's been in the job since the year 2000, as a reporter and editor, when I was the editor of OC Weekly, I would have my reporters check out, and they quickly picked up the habit of checking out the auditor's reports on California state government. And they have always been fascinating, candid, often brutal. in their assessment of how badly run California government has been in her tenure. This is part of the reason that we know that, you know, there's a real problem inside the financial accounting system for the state is that Elaine Howell, wrote about high-tech failures in this state going back, you know, now two decades. And one of those was the one that I mentioned just a moment ago. They still have this system from 2006, which has not delivered the financials on time. The system itself is not complete. It was supposed to be complete by like 2008. Not done, still not done in 2022. This is the state that wants to save climate change and stop wildfires and end homelessness and cure addiction and you name it. We're going to eradicate poverty in this state, but cannot stand up an electronic accounting system, a high-tech accounting system. She is leaving. And that puts the state assembly and the governor in the driver's seat on selecting her successor. The only person I know statewide who would be able to manage that is John Morlock, former state senator from Orange County. And I don't say this just because I know and like John and that he's a friend. It's because John Morlock was the guy. You mentioned the Orange County bankruptcy and the failure to understand that what goes up must come down in the stock market to some level. And Morlock was out there in 93 campaigning for county treasurer and was saying, look, these people have invested in riskier and riskier assets to make up the growing disparity between what they owe on government and what they aspire to do in government and how much tax revenue they've got. With the result, he said, he predicted in 93, 94, there's going to be a bankruptcy. And sure enough, in 1994, Orange County files the largest municipal bankruptcy in American history at that point. Pardon me again. And suddenly the guy who'd been ridiculed as a right-wing evangelical zealot who was just, you know, a conservative knucklehead rises to the top of everybody's charts. Well, he's a certified financial planner. He's a CPA. He is a numbers literate guy. And he really steered Orange County out of the bankruptcy so successfully that he was elected to County Board of Supervisors and then State Senate and consequently made himself a target of the left, the government unions primarily, who did not like his candid assessments of state finances, which he produced even as a state senator. So you can count on the assembly and the legislature. They're fighting right now over the makeup of the commission that will select Elaine Howell's successor. But you can imagine that people who are in this position don't really like an Elaine Howell. They're not looking for a John Morlock. This is like asking organized crime to get together and pick the DA. That's what we're going to get very likely. In reality, if you really look at what Elaine Howell did, she did a tremendous public service with almost no impact. She had been warning for more than 15 years, I think, about unemployment office handling of unemployment claims. This is the EDD, the Employment Development Division of the state. And frequent listeners to the show and readers of newspapers know that the EDD subsequently went on during COVID to lose upwards of $31 billion, including $20 billion to organized crime. So this is a state that can't find its own butt with both hands and its pants down. And yet they're going to now pick the next auditor. So this is a challenge.
Do you think this should be an elected position?
No, I don't think it would do any better with the electorate. I sincerely believe that what would happen then is
but I wrote a book called Crisis of Responsibility,
yes.
And I don't care if the electorate gets it wrong. They can then deal with it. But you could, I guess what you would say is that the electorate elected Newsom.
Yes, and the assembly and the senators who are going to pick this person.
Okay, but here's the difference from a representative form of government, that the supermajority nature of the state. Yeah, I mean, I guess you just carry it through its logical conclusion. You're stuck with the same thing. There are positions, though, that are appointed by Newsom and the legislator. And that the consequences are different. Like, it seems to be the auditor, there is a bit of potential for grift.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, we do elect the auditor in the county level. Why don't
yes.
we elect it at the state level?
It's a good question. I don't know the history of, you know, those divergent paths to the
You're
office.
You're right. We wouldn't get a different result right now. But I will say this. In other states, you could. and I've made this point time and time again, right now when people come to me and say, we got to get pumped up, we have a chance to take the insurance commissioner mm-hmm. or the secretary of state.
Or
and
education.
I go, we don't. The down ballot realities are, but you know, you do get mixed ballot voting in other blue states.
That's true. Yeah, I just don't, my read of election results is that people really don't know who to vote for in these races. And in California's open primary, jungle primary, and general election, you would have two Democrats facing off against each other for this office, each one backed by the union. A little bit like when Donald Trump has two QAnon people he can back in a congressional race or a state elections board race. He'll back the one who's most obsequious. Same thing here.
But
with
you can't go wrong with two QAnons.
I know there's going to be
someone is going to end these sex trafficking rings.
Among the don't, yes.
Did you know that Q, the guy, like the person behind it, and we don't know it's a guy. I shouldn't have said that. He's gender neutral.
Or one person.
Did you know that no one knows where he is? He's been gone for like over a year, disappeared after predicting Trump would take office.
I didn't know there was an actual person. I really thought this whole thing was made up. Seriously.
For all we know, it is. But there was like a leader, and no one knows where the person is. He hasn't posted on what's their chat board they all like there. Yeah, we'll have to ask some of our listeners that are more familiar with Q than we are.
Yeah.
So the auditor thing, at the end of the day, I think you got to continue the story about the waste and fraud at the unemployment deal. I want to know why you have an auditor if you can't eliminate this stuff.
Well, this is it. It's an advisory report only. There's no requirement. This is not legally binding on anybody. It's a little bit like having a noisy dog next door chained up that barks all day and night.
Auditors generally are not merely advisory. They generally, when you use an auditor in the private sector, they're giving actionable information.
Right, because somebody could be sued. The board could be sued by shareholders, am I right?
Sure.
Or investors. The same thing is not really true in California. If you ignore the auditor's findings on something and you screw up again, the voters still vote for you. Those are your shareholders, I suppose. But there's no punishment. They're not going to take you to court. It is a flawed, I think. It's an unfortunately flawed comparison because in the private sector, you have real interest groups fighting against one another who want profitability and can hold people accountable almost immediately. You can get CEOs fired. You can have board members eliminated all because of shareholder return. Although that's becoming politicized. So I don't know. You're better informed on that than I am, but that's just my sense. Hey, can we move on to what's called CalCare? This is, I warned everybody this is coming. We covered this about a year ago, a piece of legislation moving through the state assembly. It's Assembly Bill 1400, and it was shelved last year when it didn't get enough votes. But this is a bill that would create a single-payer healthcare system. And single payers, for those who don't know, it really means there will be one single payer, one single insurance company, if you will. That'll be the state of California, and doctors will continue to deliver private healthcare, right? Here's the fact, though. This is an attempt basically to put the state of California in charge of determining how much a doctor can charge. Doctors can charge X, but not X plus Y. And they're always going to drive that cost down as if anybody in the legislature really truly understands how much it costs to do an MRI or to draw a blood test or to talk to a patient or, you know, whatever. None of these people in our state house have ever proved they know how to run a business. And as you know, maybe there's a few Republicans in there who've actually run some, but very, very few Democrats I'm aware of have ever tried to run anything more difficult than a hairdryer. So those people will be put in charge of determining what doctors can actually charge and how much they can be reimbursed for in this new scheme. It will be totalizing. It will make all doctors, all hospitals, basically employees of the state. This is very much, and I don't want to get too much into the weeds here, but this is very much like Lorena Gonzalez's bill, which is headed toward Newsom's desk, which will create collective bargaining under a commission directed by the state for anybody who works in the fast food industry. And it's an attempt to turn all those employees in the fast food industry basically to employees of the state. The state will tell fast food companies how to operate those employees. It will do the same thing here in healthcare. this to me is a terrifying grab. That's part one. Imagine a state that cannot run the unemployment office or the DMV or virtually anything else, wildfire management, housing crisis, you name it, can't deliver water. They can't get us a cup of water. They can't finish the high-speed rail. They're going to be in charge of health care. Just when you think of the state in charge of healthcare, imagine those unfinished roads out there in the Central Valley, those rail beds for the high-speed rail. That's where we're headed. And yet they're going to not just double, but they are going to raise by 200% the state budget. It's going to go up. I'm sorry. They're going to. Yes.
Your prediction as to how what happens? Do you think this passes?
No. And here's why. It won't pass this year. But only for one reason. Now, when I read the mainstream press,
it only takes one reason.
Okay. Well, there's actually maybe two. There are lots of interest groups out there. The California Medical Association, hospital groups, insurers. They're gonna bring a lot of cash to the game too. I think the more interesting political calculation is that we've got elections this year. There is no way the taxes associated with this, which we've published an article on at California Policy Center. It's called California Considers Doubling Its Taxes. I want to pause in that phrase. California considers doubling its taxes. We're going to double the tax income, the taxation of Californians and their businesses in order to support this new healthcare system, which will cost two times as much on its own as the entire state budget right now. It's going to be in excess of $400 billion per year, probably closer to $500 billion. That's about twice as much as our current entire budget. So do you really want to head into a June election or a November election, Governor Newsom, with a tax revolt on your hands, not just on the part of the right and some affected businesses under healthcare, doctors, hospitals, et cetera? Do you really want the people of California taking a look at this incredible tax hit that everybody's going to experience statewide? This is, if there's nothing else that will destroy confidence in California among Californians, it's going to be the state takeover, if not because of the crappy quality of health care that it will invariably, certifiably, certainly deliver to us ultimately. The short-term consequences of raising taxes that much, that quickly on Californians who are already living in the highest cost state in the union, not because of health care costs. Those people are going to flee this state. And who will come in? People who aren't making as much money, who won't have to pay as much in taxes, and who will benefit from tremendous free, quote-unquote, health care.
So my question is, what is going on here? Because I think everything you said is right, and I think everything you said Newsom agrees with, that this can't get passed in that form. It's politically undoable. So is he setting himself up for a 24 presidential run by saying, I tried to do something bold in California and the lobbyists stopped me? Because you know how much that guy hates lobbyists. Mm-hmm. Or is he reading the tea leaves wrong and he thinks he does have a mandate to get this done? Or does he think he can have it fail and it doesn't have a blowback politically? I mean, in the past, big, bold, audacious goals that don't go through, Hillary care in 94, Biden's entire agenda last year, usually that's humiliating to politicians. Mm-hmm. So why float this thing if it isn't going to go?
Well, so he's not floating it.
No, he's behind it.
Yes and no. It may be, because here's another.
So is that what you think it is? Is that he's actually maybe more clever than we think, that he's allowing other people to be the face and he wants to kind of see how the wind blows. And if it doesn't go through, he doesn't have his fingerprints on it. And if it does go through, he then jumps on.
I think that's exactly why. And I think there's another possibility that this is a good fake. This is a play action pass. You run this gigantic, high profile and likely unpopular bill in an election year when every member of the legislature is going to be looking over his or her shoulder, especially those people on the front lines, those Democrats who really do have more purpley kinds of districts. And they look at the possibility of raising taxes on their constituents and they say, I ain't going to do this. But everybody's paying attention to that while Newsom fakes that handoff, turns around and globalizes Medi-Cal for illegal immigrants and can therefore claim, look, I did more to expand access to health care in California than anybody on the single payer side or anybody on the right. I'm the genius who figured out how to make this happen and get half a loaf better than none. I think it's a possibility. There's just a deep fake. And he, not in the, I shouldn't have used that word. I meant it in the sports sense. It's a fake. It's a juke. He's pretending that this, he wants this other thing out there because it will draw the ire of people like you and me and other commentators who've called this thing ridiculous, even on the left. But you can read this, you know, articles from George Skelton and Dan Walters and others who are really astute political observers who are considered kind of moderate in their perspectives. These are people who are saying, like, this is a clown act, this whole single-payer system. Californians left and right are not going to go for a gigantic hike in their taxes on the hope, the promise that someday they're going to have something like, I don't know, Swedish or German healthcare that's, you know, an unlimited buffet bar, as Americans think. You know, it's you and I know the truth about European healthcare, and so do Europeans. But I think that's what's possibly going on here. It's a political game. Nonetheless, you know, there is the chance that knuckleheads will rule the day and AB 1400 will pass both houses. It's already moved through the first subcommittee hurdle it had to very easily, including getting a guy who's associated with CMA, the California Medical Association, to vote for it. Jim Woods, I think, is his name. So Californians ought to pay attention to this. Our listeners ought to be watching AB 1400. But really watch more closely Newsom's budget, which is expanding health care by other means, non-legislative means.
I think it's a good answer. It's going to be interesting to kind of watch. But I don't know. The politics of it are of interest to me, but we got to move on. So.
Okay. I want to end up, if I can, with just one last story here. It's a minor one, but this is a and I will acknowledge, full disclosure, my personal animus for L.A. Times columnist Michael Hiltzik. He is
that guy is a complete toolbox.
Yeah. I referred to him late at night, I think on Saturday on Twitter. I was doing a little shaving, paused, looked at this article that he had written, and I'm going to describe it in a second, and immediately tweeted out that he was an ass gasket. That, and I mean the donkey. I'm not referring to the hindquarters of a man.
Thank you for that.
Yeah. I didn't really cover myself there in glory. Sorry about that. My wife took my phone away from me that night. I was a bad person. Anyway, here's the background. A woman named Kelly Earnby, and she's from Orange County. She worked in the DA's office. She was a political activist down here, very conservative, opposed vaccine mandates. She died from COVID.
When you say political activist, she was a candidate for Supes, and she was assistant DA.
Yeah. No, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with activists. She ran for office. She lost, but she was still active. She was out
there. Yeah, I'm saying an activist can make it sound like sort of a citizen volunteer who's kind of a,
I see.
What do you call me, a political commentator? She was in the arena, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
absolutely. So. She ran. Yeah. But she remained active even when she lost. She was committed. Yeah. She didn't just go away like, that was my one shot and I don't care anymore. She stayed active. And one of the things that really had her fired up was vaccine mandates. And then when she dies either from or with COVID, I'm not entirely clear, and I don't know that anybody is, but she certainly had a severe and bad case of COVID that went downhill fast, and it killed her.
And she's a year younger than I am, and so I think it's an entirely appropriate thing to assume that there was some other comorbidities involved that are none of our business. They haven't been disclosed, but either way, go ahead. Is it possible this is just one of the hyper-rare 46-year-old healthy women who died purely of isolated COVID? Of course, it's possible. But I also think statistically, it's okay for me to assume that there may have been other health things going on, that she died with COVID, not from COVID. But again, we don't know. But I know where you're going with this, and I want you to get there because I'm about to get fired up on this thing.
Well, her death was seized on, as these deaths often are, of people who oppose vaccine mandates actually go farther and oppose the vaccine and say that it's, you know, it's bad or somehow it's monkey business, and then die from COVID. The pro-vax crowd, you and I are very pro-vaccine. That's not even the vaccine extremists who believe that people should be held down, muzzled, and jabbed with the COVID vaccine, Moderna.
No, not just the COVID vaccine, the booster, the second booster, the third booster.
Yeah.
Every 6 weeks,
yes.
Your new boost.
There was no vaccine is enough.
These people are such idiots.
Yeah.
But they
seize on this. There are whole websites, blogs, Substacks, Reddits that are dedicated to illuminating these deaths of people who said, I don't believe in the vaccine, or I think that vaccine mandates are wrong.
And you say illuminating, and that is you being charitable as a reporter. They're celebrating their death.
They celebrate the death.
That's what they're doing. They're celebrating the death of somebody.
Yeah, and that, in fact, is Michael Hiltzik's title. Now, reporters aren't responsible necessarily for the headlines of their stories, but Hiltzik doubles down on this one. It's celebrating COVID deaths is ghoulish but necessary. Another headline, you can see it's still in the URL. It was his first one. Why shouldn't we dance on the graves of anti-vaxxers? It is a celebration of celebrating people's death from COVID.
But was that headline in the L.A. Times?
Yes.
That's
disgusting.
I can't believe it is in the LA Times.
That's why my reaction was so bad that night when I texted out that he was, as I said. So, you know, I just want to cite a couple of things here.
Isn't that a little over the top for the LA Times?
It's way over the top.
I mean, for the LA Times.
Even for the LA Times.
I think it is.
That's become over the top. He says, Earnby's death has come to symbolize the rift in the social fabric caused by the ravages of COVID.
No, it hasn't. That's not true.
No, it's not true. You want to interrupt and go ahead?
First of all, her death has come to symbolize the fact that a person who is a daughter and a wife and a friend and a human
mother.
Being died. That's what it symbolizes. Second of all, it doesn't symbol. It's not this trying to extract some sort of political message out of it, devoid of fact. You know how many hours went by after her death before they start talking about the vaccine? And so I get a text from someone in D.C., who I'm not going to say their name, said she must have been vaxxed because all we would be hearing about is how she wasn't.
Right.
And then when they start saying that she wasn't, they first started off with how she opposed vaccine mandates.
Right.
It's very obvious to me that the people that are taking the position of this idiot are all desperately afraid of another fact coming out that's going to contradict their narrative because they're all walking on eggshells mm-hmm. around it. But you say, oh, they've turned into this vax thing or anti-vax thing and this and that. They did it with Herman Cain before there
yes.
was a vaccine
yes.
about masking.
That's right.
You take an 80-year-old man, somewhat large, with cancer and other conditions,
right.
and he dies of COVID, and they take a picture of him without a mask on, and they go, see, this is what
yes.
Trump has done. And
you've got it.
So this isn't just a vax thing. It's them looking to medicalize dunking on people you don't like politically.
And
F these people.
Yes.
They're absolutely, totally contemptible.
Yes, agree. So here's his taxonomy of COVID deniers. It's people who, for legitimate reasons, can't get a vaccine, like children, he says. Second, they may have legitimately faced some obstacles in getting to a vaccination site. Third, people who refuse the vaccine because they've been deceived by others. And then fourth, and David, this includes you and me here in his taxonomy of people, it's those who have couched our opposition in policy terms. Earnby fell into that category, asserted opposition not to the vaccines as such, but to vaccination mandates. He goes on, I just want to point out that this
But what's the logic of that? Okay, because it is true that I'm vehemently against vaccine mandates. And it is true that other people might have a legitimate political argument for one, and they're wrong, but that it's legitimate. It's allowed in the course of debate. But never in the history of the world do we say, when you oppose mandating something and someone dies from, I do not oppose mandating that people don't ride motorcycles. Yet some people do die on motorcycle accidents. And so the notion that therefore you are, when you are against a mandate of prohibiting motorcycles, therefore you are leading to the death of these people. That's the argumentation here. The fact of the matter is that he knows categorically there's a difference between one's political posture around freedom and the different things that can happen medically in a risk-oriented society. It is absurd to say that vax mandates are to be equivalent with that issue. Now, I would even argue, apart from the mandate and the political side of it, that even one's own personal decision doesn't mean they should be dunked on
That's
for
right.
it. They take a risk. They know what the risk is.
Yes. So here's his line. I want to bring this home for you and me because we're in this position of opposing mandates. He says it should be clear that opposing vaccine mandates as a substitute for opposing vaccination itself is a fundamentally incoherent position. It's little more than the garden variety small government Republican ideology. So he reveals his hand. This is about Republicans that he doesn't like. And that's important because who opposed the vaccine in its earliest days? Michael Hiltzik.
This guy.
Yes. Trump's plotting for a pre-election vaccine carries real dangers for your health. This is in September of 2020. The vaccine is just weeks off from approval under the emergency use authorization. But there's also something else coming, a showdown between Trump and Biden. And we can't have Trump get a win here. The Trump administration is plainly counting on a vaccine for COVID-19 becoming approved by election in the expectation that news of the discovery will inspire a tide of public optimism that will sweep Trump to election. Here's a more judicious counsel about how you should be reacting to the administration's push for rapid approval of a vaccine. Be afraid. Be very afraid. I won't read the whole thing, David. There's just lots in here that shows
so
Michael.
So you could argue, by his logic, that Kelly Irnby is responsible for the death of Kelly Irnby and that this guy is responsible for genocide.
That's right. Absolutely 100%. He does not add that in his taxonomy. People like him who have been guilty of making people skeptical of the vaccine.
Do me a favor. Don't ever bring up that guy again on this podcast.
Oh, I love you, brother. Hey, we've got an interview that I did with my friend, the historian John Bicknell on John C. Fremont. I'm not going to subject you to that, David. But listeners who like California history will remember that John C. Fremont plays an integral role in the Bear Flag Revolt. He's an American Army officer and explorer. Just an absolutely fascinating interview. And that'll come right after we end here, as we always do, by saying that you can find this podcast on the National Review website. But it would be easier for you and better for us if you just subscribe and, of course, rate and review the show. Hey, rate and review the show. I got to emphasize this. If you do that, other people it makes it more likely that other people will find us. You can email us with comments and story suggestions. I really appreciate that. You'll find our email addresses and other fun details in the show notes. You can follow us on Twitter at The Radio Free CA. On behalf of my friend and co-host David Bonson, we give thanks as ever to show producer Sarah Schutte, engineers Brian Tong and Glenn Hall, and all of our friends at National Review. Thanks also to Metalachi, the LA-based mariachi and metal band, for our music. La revolución continúa en la semana próxima. Sarah, can you roll that interview right now? So with me is my friend John Bicknell, and he is the author of Lincoln's Pathfinder, John C. Fremont and the Violent Election of 1856. John, you tell us a little bit about Fremont. We know he was a military officer and explorer. He was married to the daughter of political powerhouse Thomas Hart Benton, but he also played a role that I did not know about, shamefully, until I read your book, which came out, 3-4 years ago now?
2017.
Yeah. That he played a pivotal role in California statehood, and it's sort of haunted me that I need to go back and dig into this. And I thought, well, you know, I've got this excuse to find out more from the guy who actually knows a lot about John C. Fremont. Before we get to California, can you just tell me, like, give us a broader picture of who this guy was and why he matters?
Sure. Fremont was, in the middle of the 19th century, one of the most famous men in America. He was an explorer, an army officer, part of the top Corps of Topographical Engineers, who had great connections. He was, as you said, married to Jessie Benton, who was the daughter of Thomas Hart Benton, one of the leading proponents of Manifest Destiny, of westward expansion. And Fremont parlayed that relationship into quite a career. Five exploring expeditions to the West, probably most famously the 1843-44 expedition, which I wrote about in an earlier book, excuse me. And that the report from that book, which he wrote and which Jesse edited into a romantic tale, was a bestseller, government publication that became a bestseller, was a guide for Western explorers, really made Fremont a famous person.
So is he simultaneously an explorer and a military officer? Do you hold one post while doing your exploring?
Yes, he was the topographical engineers, like the Army Corps of Engineers today, were a branch within the Army that did reconnaissance and exploration, mostly in the West, but not exclusively in the West.
So his marriage, you mentioned Jessie, the daughter of Thomas Hart Benton. Who's Thomas Hart Benton? And tell us a little bit about Jessie, who in your account actually is, you mentioned already that she's got some literary instincts there that really pay him homage, really illuminate his work and help it become widely popular. She's also a woman of some courage, and there's a sense, I think, in reading your book, if I remember correctly, that she gets this kind of stubbornness and self-confidence from her own father, and he recognizes that. So who is Thomas Hart Benton? And then tell us a little bit about Jesse, his daughter.
That's right. Benton was a senator from Missouri for 30 years. He was the first senator from Missouri when it became a state, 1821, and served until 1851. He was unceremoniously defeated for re-election when he endorsed the Compromise of 1850. He was the head of the Military Affairs Committee, which is how he was able to help Fremont so often. Mm-hmm. From that position. Jesse grew up at his knee, was literally dandled on Andrew Jackson's knee in the White House, and was, had she lived today, she would have been the kind of political force that her father was in his day.
Mm-hmm. And but when her father first meets Fremont, he's not really thrilled by this match, is he?
No, Fremont was a decade or so older than her when they met. I think she was 17. Benton opposed the match, wanted to marry her off to someone else. But she fell head over heels in love and was very stubborn, as you mentioned about it. They eventually literally ran off together to get married, which later on cost Fremont some political problems, but also was a political asset because they used that sort of boldness to differentiate him from the bachelor James Buchanan in the 1856 campaign.
So we're now nearing the it's either the exploration or we're actually getting like close to the Mexican War. And there's an incident you recount involving a howitzer and Jesse. And I want to know, like, first of all, what's a howitzer? If you'll remind us, I'm not a gun guy. So what's a howitzer and why does Jesse's role here become really critical for Fremont?
A howitzer is just, it's a cannon. It's a piece of artillery that Fremont wanted to take with him on the 43-44 expedition in case they ran into any trouble. He didn't have the approval of his military superiors to do this, but he requisitioned the cannon and they gave it to him, excuse me, in St. Louis as he headed west. And after he left, a few days after he left, an order came telling him to return the cannon and probably would have been stopped from going on the expedition. Jesse intercepted the message, sent a message forward to Fremont telling him that this was happening and he should just get going, move faster, get away with the cannon, and which he did. And then the combination of Jesse and Thomas Hart Benton after the fact protected Fremont from any repercussions. He had a lot of trouble with military superiors who he and Jesse both felt sort of came down hard on him because of his connection to Benton and because he wasn't a part of the West Point officer class.
So yeah, he comes outside that elite academy. He rises right up through the ranks, mostly on merit, but perhaps also because he has his famous patron, his father-in-law. And that takes us, you know, I'm skipping over lots of detail in the book, but that takes us to the dawn of, you know, the American War with Mexico. And he arrives in California, 1846. This is before statehood, of course. It's even before gold has been discovered, 1849-ish. And he arrives in California as the Bear Flag Revolt erupts. And before we talk a little bit about that, I just want to say, like, for the longest time, I think all I knew about Fremont was that he was allegedly, and now I now know only allegedly, at the time I was told that back in high school and college, well, Fremont really stirred this thing up. He was trying to set, he was like, this was an actual strategy on the part of the administration in Washington to separate the Mexicans from their territory in the U.S. And so Fremont is involved in this. And I think you say, that's not true.
There's actually.
Things were pretty stirred up before Fremont got there. There's a theory that he was, sent west with orders from Benton or from the Secretary of War to do something. It's never really quite spelled out what that was supposed to be. There's no record indicating this. And more importantly, Fremont's activities before the Bear Flag revolt do not indicate that he was on some sort of secret mission. He was sort of meandering around, certainly took his time getting to California, if that's what he was supposed to be doing out there. Once he got there, it is likely, there is a record that he met with Thomas Larkin, who was the U.S. consul to Mexico living in California, and an army officer named Gillespie in May of that year, where he likely did get some instructions from the Polk administration to do something. But even there, it's not really clear what those orders were.
So in any case, as you say, there's already skullduggery, but it's just, people really are starting to rise up. There's already antipathy among the Californios, that is, people of Mexican descent or Spanish descent, perhaps, who live in this territory of California. There's already antipathy for Mexico, for the central government, which has kind of ignored these people and left them, they think, to fight off the Native Americans on their own and to try to fend off other marauders. Anglo-Americans are coming in. They're upset because they don't feel like they've got equal access to land and opportunity under the Mexicans. And so in 1846, this kind of resentment boils over and you get the Bear Flag Revolt in the summer, I think, of June or so of 1846.
Right.
Yeah. And Fremont's there. And this is a part I'd like you to tell me a little bit about. There's some sort of election among the rebels who are themselves primarily I don't know if you can call them Californians. They're Americans from the East who've come into California primarily. And they have, if I remember my history correctly, they've made off with a bunch of horses that were destined for a Mexican garrison somewhere. They've actually arrested a Mexican general with whom they had been on very friendly terms. The Mexican general sort of surprised in his pajamas or something. And they say, you're under arrest. And he says, well, come on in and have a drink and let's talk. But Fremont shows up in this period as these guys are raising the Bear Flag with significantly a red star that is supposed to echo the rebel Republic of Texas in the war with Mexico. And how does Fremont end up at the kind of head of this group of rebels to the extent that he does?
It's some way symbolic. He takes them to a hilltop, a mountaintop, after they've, as you say, arrested the local leader. There were a lot of, as there are today, I suppose, a rivalry between Northern California and Southern California. The Mexican authorities in those two areas were not quite at war, but certainly weren't getting along. Fremont takes command of this group, makes some demonstrations, but doesn't really take any military action. By the time that's all settled, the Navy, they realize that this is all before war is declared. Once war is declared between the United States and Mexico, or they find out about war being declared, the Navy shows up. Admiral Sloat says California now belongs to the United States. Robert Stockton succeeds him and decides he's going to appoint Fremont governor.
But there is a period of 4 days. The Bear Flag Republic or the California Republic exists for a period of a few weeks, I think, right, or several days. And for four whole days, Fremont is somehow elected or takes control of this rebel band and is kind of their he's their president, if you will, or their, of this republic for four whole days.
Sure.
And so As you say, the U.S. Navy arrives, Sloat declares the region, they strike the bear flag, they raise the stars and stripes, and war against Mexico is on. Somewhere in this period, our guy, John Fremont, ends up a gigantic landowner. He, if I remember the story as you recounted, he pays a Mexican, let's call him aristocrat, or, you know, some ranchero, $3,000 for a vast tract of land that's at that point called Las Mariposas. Some of us know that as Mariposa County today. Talk to us about that land deal, because this is going to bring Thomas Hart Benton back into the picture in a big way, ultimately. But he owns this big tract. How does he acquire this land? Why does he want it? Can you explain that whole piece?
Right. He buys, he buys this land. He actually doesn't know where it is. He thinks it's he thinks it's closer to San Francisco. It turns out it's out in the Sierra. And this is in 1847. So it's a year. The war is not quite over. And this is before gold is discovered, though people have told him there's gold on this property. So he buys this Mexican land grant, essentially, which is what caused all the problems later, and then stumbles onto riches on this piece of property that he didn't even know where it was. Eventually, he and Jesse moved there and lived there part-time.
So they live there part-time. They stumble upon gold, I guess, about the time of the gold rush. Is that right? 1849? Yeah. Now, of course, the gold rush wipes out John Sutter. He's got all these, I guess you would call them claim jumpers today, you know, but people, or squatters, people who just come onto Sutter's property. They burn down his house or his fort, and then famously just kind of take over his land. Sutter spends the rest of his lifetime trying to, you know, pleading with Congress to reimburse him for this loss and to recognize his ownership of this property. To no avail. Fremont has a better exit strat. Well, not a strategy, but he has a better opportunity to exit this thing. And that's where Thomas Hart Benton comes in.
Right. He had an opportunity. Fremont also had problems with squatters. It's just as people were flooding in after, in 1849 and forward. Part of that helped make him unpopular in some circles, because he was trying to get people off his land. I'm trying to remember the year. It was in the early 1850s, where he was trying to get out from under this, partly because of the squatters and disputes about title to the land. And Benton found a buyer that offered Fremont $1 million for this piece of property,
and that's $1 million at the time, not
at the
in
time.
Current.
That I don't know what that would be. At least tens of millions of dollars today, yeah. Maybe more. And Fremont turned it down. At this point, Benton, who had bailed, had given Fremont his start, had supported him at every turn, had helped him with the president. He had been court-martialed for his actions during the Mexican War. And Polk pardoned him, partly because of what Benton wanted him to do. Benton throws up his hands and says, "Look, you're on your own, son," and walked away. Now, by that point, Benton had really lost most of his political power. After losing a Senate seat, he'd been elected to one term in the House, and then lost a re-election bid. Because he wouldn't support the Kansas-Nebraska Act. So he was sort of out of favor anyway, but at that point, Benton had enough of Fremont.
Yeah, hard to, looking not just a gift horse, but a woolly mammoth in the mouth or something. I mean, this is a huge deal for him, would have set him, it would have made him one of the richest people in America, it seems. And he turns it down. And he turns it down in the midst of all these land title troubles that, this would have easily just swept away. But it also leaves a bad taste, as you mentioned earlier, in the I was going to say, in the mouths of a lot of Californians, because by the time we got the Bear Flag Revolt and we've got this whole land deal with Las Mariposas, and he decides he's going to run for president in 1856. And some of this stuff comes, Benton's unable to help him now and won't if he can. But you've got the allegation that he executed prisoners during the Bear Flag Revolt. There are allegations of cannibalism, kind of a Donner Party sort of allegation that he and his men survived on the corpses of their friends. Allegations that he had a public harem of some sort, that he was disloyal to Miss Jessie. And perhaps worst of all, that he's a Catholic. And I think you do a great job of talking about the fact that he also, back as California has become a state, he's elected its first senator. I should have paused over this fact, because this is what, 1850, the state comes in 1849, 1850 of January. He's there in D.C. to take one of the two Senate seats. As you say, he draws the short straw. So he only has this seat for a very brief time. Maybe it's not January, it might have been like November or something, but he only has this seat again for just a few months. Is that right?
That's correct. And his record as a senator is very slim because he was there only for a few months. But even in that time, he got in some hassles. He had supported this thing called Fremont's Gold Bill. It was a bill basically to ensure the kind of ownership that he had, guaranteeing these Mexican land grants were legal and handed over cleanly. That alienated many of the people that he called squatters, that were squatters on his land. He alienated some other people because there was a provision in this bill that would prevent it foreigners from owning mining claims. He was walking a very fine line there. He was trying to appeal to the sort of the know-nothing nativists without being associated too closely with them. That didn't really hurt him in California too much, but it did raise questions about how much of a nativist Fremont might be later on.
And his attempts to kind of generate populist support for his campaign in 1856, he is the first Republican presidential candidate. Is that right?
That's correct. It was something of a circus. I mean, this was a crusade in a sense. It was the first real anti-slavery presidential campaign in American history. Now they weren't abolitionists. They were opposed. The Republican Party was opposed to the expansion of slavery. But even there, it brought in all sorts of people who had really stayed outside the political process before. Frederick Douglass endorsed Fremont, for example. There were a lot of women involved in the campaign. Jessie herself was essentially the campaign manager from behind the scenes. But his Senate record, as you said, sort of came back in a big way in that campaign. The gold bill was part of it. The things you mentioned, I mean, some of it was true and some of it wasn't. Some of it was exaggerated.
Well, can we go through the list? Is there evidence he executed prisoners during the Bear Flag Revolt?
There were prisoners executed during the Bear Flag Revolt. There were two Americans who were executed by the Mexicans, it was famous in the day, Cowie and Fowler.
Oh, that's yes.
Were very famous names in that period. Some said Kit Carson was the one who killed these guys who were trying to escape. Killing prisoners trying to escape is always the excuse when you execute. Mm-hmm. Right. Fremont said that the killing was done by his Delaware Indian scouts in retaliation for the murders of Cowie and Fowler. No one ever actually claimed Fremont, pulled a trigger, but he was in overall command of the troops. So whether it was the Delaware scouts or Kit Carson or somebody else, it was done under Fremont's command, if not his orders.
Got it. How about cannibalism?
Yes. On the fourth expedition, where he was in Colorado looking for a path for a railroad, transcontinental railroad, they got caught in the snow. He sent a party out toward Taos, New Mexico to get relief. They didn't hear back. He then took his own group to look for those guys, leaving a larger group behind. They found the first group, went on to Taos, got supplies, came back. A lot of the people that they left behind had died. The ones that were still alive had eaten one of those who died.
Oh, dear. It's a different era. Also, and this is interesting because you cite the LA paper, which was very big in the 19th century, the Los Angeles Star, as this just really rabid anti-Fremont kind of newspaper. And they also accuse him of creating and, shepherding around the state a public harem, or perhaps even around the West.
Yeah, a Democratic paper, a pro-slavery paper.
Mm-hmm.
Fremont had a private harem, at least. Hmm. There's plenty of evidence to indicate that, like many politicians then and today, were not exactly faithful to their wives. Public harem is a little, again, that's sort of a partisan exaggeration of an actual fact. Which there was a lot of in the 1856 campaign, including the last example, Catholicism.
Yeah.
Being a Catholic in 1850 is a bit of a conflict, because certainly Democrats embraced Irish immigrants. A large block of Democratic voters were Catholic. So accusations that he was a Catholic sort of bounced back a little bit. It hurt him with nativist voters. And might well have cost him Pennsylvania in the election.
And it certainly does him no good out here in California, because he runs in 1856. I don't think he even wins California. Is that right? He can't even turn out the vote in this state.
Now, California only had 3 electoral votes, I think. It wasn't the kind of state it is today. But he had other problems. Democratic Party was strong in California. Republicans were not organized at all in the state. The problems we already talked about with squatters. A large pro-slavery element in California, a lot of Southern immigrants certainly were not friendly to Fremont. The Catholicism thing, I mean, he got married by a priest. So when he and Jesse ran off, that's who they could find, and that's who married them. He had a French Catholic father. There was plenty of things people could point to make an accusation that Fremont was Catholic. To his credit, he simply refused to countenance this criticism. He's arguing that there was nothing wrong with being a Catholic, and he wasn't going to make a big case about him not being one. And his advisors begged him to do it. They knew it was killing him in some of these nativist friendly areas in Indiana and Pennsylvania, but he wouldn't do it, and it's not what cost him the election.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't help.
What did cost him the election, 1856?
The election, in my opinion, the election of 1856 was an election between the sort of the crusade feeling of the Republican Party, the anti-slavery hope, versus the fear of instilled by the Democratic candidate James Buchanan and his minions, that the election of Fremont would mean disunion. And he was right. That accusation was correct. If Fremont had been elected, what happened in 1860-61 would have happened almost certainly in 1856-57. Not enough things had happened to convince enough people in the North that it was worth the risk. Following the election of 1856, you had the Dred Scott decision. You had John Brown's raid, Harper's Ferry. Many things happened in Kansas, for example. You had many things that happened in the intervening 4 years that made it possible for Lincoln to win that did not make it possible for Fremont, and it was simply too new. The Republican Party wasn't organized enough in enough states. They carried most of the North even without that, losing New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Indiana.
So you the title of your book is Lincoln's Pathfinder, John C. Fremont and the Violent Election of 1856. Lincoln's Pathfinder, the word pathfinder, of course, is a double entendre here, I think. He is truly an explorer, and he's also kind of, I guess, charting the course for that Lincoln would follow just 4 years later.
That's right. And as I say in the introduction of the book, he was called the Pathfinder, but really he was, as an explorer, he was more of a path popularizer. He didn't find new routes. He trailed behind other people and then made those routes famous. But in politics, he really did lead the way.
He was a trailblazer. Yeah.
He was a trailblazer for Lincoln, and he showed the Republican Party what it needed to do, that it needed to get organized. It needed a less reticent candidate. Fremont was not really a political type. He was sort of moody, not a backslapper, certainly didn't like to take orders or advice from other people, military officers or politicians, and didn't do much to help himself in the 1856 campaign. So when 1860 rolled around, the Republicans had seen what they had in 1856 and what they needed to do differently in 1860.
So take us home here. He loses 1856. Lincoln comes in, wins 1860. Civil War ensues. And tell us what happens to John C. Fremont thereafter, quickly, if you can.
Fremont becomes a general. He's put in charge of the Department of the West, headquartered in St. Louis, sort of the Benton's home turf. He, in August of 1861, issues an order emancipating all the slaves in Missouri.
Wow.
Lincoln orders him to rescind that order. Fremont refuses, sends Jesse to Washington to try to persuade Lincoln to change his mind. Lincoln, of course, doesn't change his mind. And eventually Fremont is relieved of his command in Missouri. There's a great uproar. Republican members of Congress want Fremont reinstated. He eventually is. He takes a command in the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia. He's an unsuccessful general. He's not a good field commander. Eventually loses that job too. For a short time as a candidate for president in 1864, after Atlanta is taken, it becomes clear Lincoln is probably going to be reelected. Fremont withdraws and essentially disappears from the scene of the Civil War. Eventually loses all his money, and Jesse supports them for the rest of their lives, writing books about Fremont's previous greatness.
This was a real thing back in the 19th century. I think of Ulysses S. Grant, of course, ending in near total poverty after a financial meltdown of his investments, writing his very famous memoirs, which are published, and I think with the help of Mark Twain. That's what resuscitates his family's fortunes. Then he dies promptly after finishing the manuscript. And here you've got Fremont's wife, Jessie, actually playing the role there of not just stenographer, but really the author of his exploits in order to keep the family together, it sounds like.
Right. She wrote many books, many of which are make for really good reading. They never got well off again. They did okay. They got by. Fremont got appointed governor of Arizona Territory, where he served for something like 18 months briefly during, or say, the Hayes administration. But even that, he sort of was trying to make a deal then rather than tending to business.
Hmm. He's a master of short tenures. Let's turn to you for a second. I met you first when we were both working as editors at watchdog.org. I had tremendous enthusiasm for your journalism and your editing instincts, of course. Was surprised to find out you're also an historian. What is it that brings you to this period of American history? Because you've got another book on the I think it's 1844, is it? 1840s? Yeah. So what is it about this period, 1840s, 50s, 60s, that really grabs you?
I've always been interested in the West. And I think it was the westward expansion part that drew me to it. My professional knowledge, I won't call it expertise, is in politics. So sort of taking those two things together, that period is really where sort of westward expansion and the politics of it come together. People cover the Civil War pretty thoroughly, but there was no book about the election of 1844. And I wanted to read one, so I decided to write one.
So you've watched from afar. You now live in Virginia, right? You're still out there? Okay. So you're watching California's, I'll say, steady documented decline, unless you're a huge fan of Governor Gavin Newsom and Jerry Brown before him. Listeners to this podcast will understand what I mean by that. But I was really intrigued, I'll end here, by your description of California politics in the early statehood period as I'm paraphrasing here, but a mishmash of freewheeling entrepreneurialism and Southern sympathies, that it was a crazy place, man. I mean, that's how you get an insurrection, the Bear Flag Revolt. It's how you get, you know, these people in the South who really, in the southern part of the state, who are really sympathetic to the slaveholding South. People in the North who are probably more the entrepreneurial type. You've got the miners all over the place, some of them who come by their land in unseemly fashion. You've got the gold fever on people in this period. It's, in some respects, as I reread your book for this conversation, I'm reminded that not a lot has changed. You know, this is a real, as much as I grew up thinking this place was Edmund G. Pat Brown's vision of a, you know, well-manicured suburban state with moderately conservative people and a moderately conservative Democratic Party, it's really still a kind of a gold fevery place. There's, you know, Hollywood and Silicon Valley and the biotech industry. But in the end, it is kind of, you could call it vibrant, I suppose. That would be the nice way to put it. What does it look like from your perspective as an historian of the period to look at California today?
Yeah, there was a lot going on and there weren't very many rules. I think the big difference today, there are a lot of rules.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about California is if you look at places like Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, you can still see today the imprint of the middle of the 19th century immigration patterns and the politics of that day on those states, that you know, north of US 40 and south of US 40, the politics are different. And while it, obviously it's changed over more than a century, you can still see those patterns. You can't really see those kinds of patterns in California. It's just been remade too many times. But in the sense that, right, you've got, Silicon Valley and Hollywood, and it's for all the regulation and government oppression, and it's still a place where people go to try to make a fortune. There's still a gold rush. It may be a lot harder today because there's a lot more rules. Now, there are also the people who have thrown up their hands and are fleeing, right? Who are heading to Montana and Wyoming and Texas and wherever else they're going. So that's sort of an interesting new development. For the first time ever, for the first time since statehood, right? Last time California didn't gain a congressional seat.
Right.
Quite possible the next census, they're going to lose one. Possible.
We just lost one. And we may yet lose more. That's true.
Lose more. Right. So, yeah. California's going to continue to be a large power in national politics for a long time, but that trend certainly has at least stopped and may begin to be reversed.
That's my friend John Bicknell. He is the author of Lincoln's Pathfinder, John C. Fremont and the Violent Election of 1856. John, thank you so much for making the time. I know it's very late for you. I'm really grateful. Let's talk again soon, shall we?
Absolutely. Thanks, Will.
Thank you.